Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Angela Hemsel, author of A River Could Be a Tree, a memoir. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our young Shin Shin Yot, Ron Benicote, and Rotem Rappaport. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This was an election week in America with control of the House and Senate in play. The U.S. midterm elections are not a particularly Jewish issue. There are plenty of members of the tribe on both sides in almost every American election. But there is one area in which I personally believe, as a Jew and rabbi, that Jewish values matter. The rush to the bottom on negative campaign ads and the level of character assassination employed seem to probe new depths in this election. Now, America has always had some pretty awful electioneering habits going back, well over 150 years, and I could give you examples of many of them that would make last week's well-publicized broadcast nastiness seem somewhat tame. Still, in an election that came just 10 days after the horrifying attack on the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, an attack that was in part engendered by hate speech and the wildly distorted publicity poured out into our very messy public spaces, it is disappointing to see that so few candidates chose to run positive, or clean, really, campaigns. There is a Jewish concept called Lashon Hara, evil speech. And if ever evil speech existed, it was in the rash of social media, online and television ads, and broadcasts that did nothing but slander the opposition's candidates. The quaint term for this is going negative, and it has been a part of political operations for decades and, well, even centuries. The President of the United States, for example, specializes in this kind of campaigning, but that doesn't make it right, and that definitely doesn't mean it has no impact on the climate of hostility and ugliness that have prevailed on our airwaves and in our inboxes. It may be becoming normal for political operatives and candidates for office to act this way, but that doesn't make it right or good. And that definitely makes America worse and encourages and cultivates the kind of hostility that impacts mentally unstable people and triggers them to act violently. I suppose it was naive of me to think that a few more violent shootings and pipe bombs in the mail would help those who aspire to lead our nation to realize that words matter, and hurtful words damage our society and contribute to a climate of fear, hatred, and violence. Can you imagine a political campaign without negative ads? Try hard, because it's actually what we should expect of our elections and our elected officials. To avoid Lashon Hara, especially when it's so obviously based on falsehoods or twisted truths at the least most of the time, should be a principal goal of our system, really of all of us. Well, in more positive news, we have now entered a new Jewish month, Kislev, the month of the Jewish Festival of Lights, Hanukkah. And so, to play us in this morning, here's our first preview of music for the eight-night holiday of dedication, latkes, and dreidels. It's from Ari Goldwag, a contemporary Hanukkah song called Hanukkah Lights.
Hanukkah light burns so bright, lifts my soul, raises my shining through the night. Ooh, 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 ooh,
That was Ari Goldwag's song, Hanukkah Lights, for Hanukkah. Begins 3 weeks from tonight. That's 21 more shopping days. Starts December 2nd for the first of 8 crazy nights. Our guest this morning is Angela Himsel, author of A River Could Be a Tree, a memoir, a remarkable new book about her own journey growing up in an evangelical doomsday Christian sect in Indiana to her own conversion to Judaism and dedicated involvement in Jewish life. Meet her. Hear her extraordinary story when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Angela Himsel has a fascinating new memoir out called A River Could Be a Tree about her remarkable journey from a very different kind of background in Indiana to Judaism. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to let you tell your story because you tell it beautifully, including a great deal of depth about your family, but what led you to the course you took?
Thanks for asking. I guess that there's a historical element to it, which I included in the book, which was that my parents, when they fell in love in the 1950s, my mother was Catholic, my father was Lutheran, and this was sort of considered a mixed marriage.
It was definitely a mixed marriage from the way you describe
exactly.
It.
And in their effort to sort of find a common ground, they stumbled upon the Worldwide Church of God, which at that time was actually called the Radio Church of God.
Right. And that was Herbert Armstrong's church.
It was Herbert Armstrong, based out of Pasadena, California. And it was certainly an apocalyptic doomsday, I would say, cult. And the world was coming to an end pretty much all the time. And we were waiting for Jesus to return. Many people kept their little slippers underneath their bed so that if Jesus returned in the middle of the night, they could slip them on and go flying through the air to meet Jesus. And I grew up in that church with my 10 siblings in southern Indiana. And just by chance, I went to the overseas office in Indiana University. I was thinking I would go to Germany, which was my ancestral homeland. And instead, I saw a brochure for Israel, for a one-year program in Israel. And I took that one instead. And
just the kind of thing that kids do, isn't it?
Well, in my case, I really thought, you know, it was a place where Jesus walked. It was the land of the patriarchs. I was very, very immersed in the biblical stories, and I had a real strong connection to Israel, although I would have said to biblical Israel, not modern-day Israel. I really didn't know much about modern-day Israel. So I went there thinking, you know, I was going to kind of walk in the footsteps of Jesus, and I discovered a different Jesus than the one I thought I knew.
That journey from southern Indiana to Bloomington, that was something of a journey all by itself, but then ending up, as you did, at Hebrew University, I believe, in Jerusalem?
That's correct, right.
The preeminent academic institution. So tell us just briefly, must have been quite a shock.
It really was a shock. I really didn't know much about Jews, certainly didn't know about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. I vaguely did because, you know, you kind of couldn't avoid it. But I didn't have any historical perspective. Really, I knew about the Holocaust, but I didn't really know about the Holocaust. It's one of those things you know but don't know. And then to take classes at the Hebrew University in which they were teaching the Bible, which I believed to be a holy book, as literature. They were teaching it as a subject, which could be open to interpretation, many different types of interpretations. And I think that that was really the shock, the idea that I could interpret the Bible myself or interpret it differently than it had already been interpreted for me.
Which is fascinating because, of course, that's where Protestant Christianity started in the first place.
Right.
Which you sort of make clear, actually, in your book. We will continue to discuss A River Could Be a Tree, a new memoir from Angela Hemsel, and her own fascinating journey to Judaism when we come back on To Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue based in northwest Tucson, is celebrating its first services, classes, and events this fall. Established by a group of passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is dedicated to creating a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. As a new progressive congregation in the northwest region of Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to all throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education classes, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming in northwest Tucson. Weekly Shabbat services in the Northwest are this week at the Oro Valley Community Center, November 16th, Friday night. Shabbat services at 6:30 p.m. Religious School and Adult Education Academy courses are at the Educational Center on Oracle Road, north of Ina. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha or me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, or to attend services or adult ed classes this week, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, or go to beitsimchatucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch, or a kvel, please email us at tojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's tojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, tojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows by streaming them from the website or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in North America. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So you've had a very interesting visit recently. Would you share that with us?
Yes. So we went to Israel with 40 community members, and it was really amazing. And I think what made it special was not only the incredible country we visited, but the people that went with us. It's funny, when you go to Israel, you're thinking about going to another country and establishing a relationship there, but actually you're building a community here, and caring, friendly, outgoing, smart people. I mean, I really enjoyed every minute.
Yeah, you get close to people. It's such an interesting experience. People do think, oh, I'm going to Israel, it'll be a fantastic experience, or they think about it as a spiritual experience, or even just a vacation, and what they end up doing is creating a community. It's really true. What was the, I'm sure there are many highlights. Yeah, I got to ask you. The same thing everybody asks me when I go on a trip. What was the most important thing? It doesn't matter if it's a three-month trip. They want to know the most important thing. I get to ask you that.
Okay, so it's a hard question, but my true answer would be that, you know, this was my 18th time going to Israel with
leading
delegation.
Leading a trip. Yeah, yeah.
Leading, not going by, yeah, going by myself, my there, family. Yeah. I can't remember how many times. But with this delegation or in any other delegations, what I focus on is people, you know, the relationship that we create. And what I find special is when something happens without you really planning ahead, and the warmth of people and their hearts that are opening to you. So the example is that we went to Israel, and apparently two of the, you know, minimum of two of the people who were on the group had an interest in tennis. Now, I'm not a tennis player and I'm not a tennis coach. I have nothing to do with besides watching and enjoying. But you know, I'm a soccer
it's not,
guy.
It's not your sport,
right? It's not my sport.
You've coached soccer. You're a football guy in the international football sense, right?
So two gentlemen approached me and say, "Hey, we would love, while we're in Israel, to go to the tennis center." And I said, okay, I don't know anyone there. But, you know, I said, I'm going to call. So I just called the office. Hi, my name is Amir. I'm from the States. I have two people that are, you know, two gentlemen who want to go. Da, da, da. And he said, look, I can't help you, but here's the seller of the director. Maybe he can help you. So I called this guy that I never met.
Don't know
and I
about.
Said, tomorrow. Tomorrow, you know. And he goes, yeah, sure. And he's a former professional tennis player. So three of them ended up going. And they came there. And by coincidence, the guy who's in charge of all tennis in Israel was also there. So they had a wonderful time, you know. And then now they're bringing the knowledge back, the relationship back, and they would do something at the JCC.
It's fascinating. I set up a trip to Israel, and we were going to go to the tennis center. The trip ended up not taking place. But again, for people really into it, and it's something that you can only really do in a small country.
That's true. That's true. And I can't imagine calling someone here and saying,
yeah,
tomorrow.
I'm showing up tomorrow. I wouldn't even call, you know? You know, can we have a couple of games with Pete Sampras? Like, yeah. Probably not. Yeah. Thanks, Amir. We'll talk next week.
All right. See you.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You've been filling us in on your experience in Eastern Europe, some remarkable Jewish communities, however, mostly historical, like Vilna and
Riga.
Riga and Latvia. But the third community that you want to talk about is really, I think, much more interesting in today's terms. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, in Ukrainian, it's called Lviv. In German, it's called Lemberg, and Austrian Airlines, when they sell you a ticket, they still use the German name for it. It was an Austro-Hungarian city for many years. And there are many points of contrast. Okay, it's the one place we went to that's not the capital of a country today. It's the capital of a province, was a province of the Austro-Hungarian Empire called Galicia. Now it's sort of the biggest city in northwestern Ukraine, but it's only maybe the fourth biggest city in Ukraine. It's not even the second or third. So one of the things that was incredibly interesting, besides comparing these modern countries to each other and their levels of development, their levels of prosperity, cleanliness, et cetera, was the fact that Vilna styles itself as the capital of all the Litvaks, and Lviv is the capital of the Galicianers. Now, they're not that far apart. There's a whole country between the two called Belarus, but it's maybe 500 miles. And a lot of Jews, even Ashkenazic Jews, I think, don't really know the difference between these two major subgroups of Eastern European Jews, Litvaks and Galicianers. And the most relevant thing is they're the two major dialects of Yiddish. And in one you say Zei Gesund, in the other you say Zei Gesind. And you can tell from how somebody ends a conversation in Yiddish whether they're a Litvak or a Galicianer.
There's some small food differences too, preferences for saltier in Litvak, a little sweeter in Galicianer. It seems very small to us today, but it was huge in those days.
Right. There's the famous Maginot Line, north of which you make gefilte fish salty and south of which you make
it sweet. That's right. Why there's two versions of Manischewitz in the stores today.
Right.
That's correct.
So the interesting thing about Lviv, Lemberg, Lvov, whatever you want to call it, the Ukrainians who control it today call it Lviv, and the people who live there have a very distinct personality. They're not typical Ukrainians or former Soviets or former Habsburgs or anything else. They're Lvivians, and they're very, very proud of their city's history. It was fought over by major empires throughout history. The Ottomans besieged it a couple times, never conquered it. The Swedes besieged it, never conquered it. The Austro-Hungarians did conquer it. The great commonwealth that existed between Poland and Lithuania for a while also conquered it. But that little known to most Americans commonwealth conquered two-thirds of Europe. I mean, all the way from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, the western coast of Turkey, most of the Balkans. It was a huge geopolitical entity.
It was a large empire for a short time, basically.
Right. And that did conquer Lvov or Lemberg, whatever. Anyway, what I want to talk about is the contrast between Jewish life there in the year 2018 and Jewish life there in the year 1918. And I guess we'll have to do that next week.
We will. We'll talk Lviv next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Now, I received complaints last Sunday from an old friend, Mona Gibson, that I hadn't used any new jokes in a long time. Since this is the 851st edition of the Too Jewish radio show, and I have always called this the old Jewish joke of the week, I'm not certain this is exactly a fair kvetch. But I'll try to see how many actually funny new Jewish jokes there are out there. Here's one. On his way to work one morning, Nathan arrives at Penn Station a bit early. He's waiting for his train, and he notices a new machine on the platform. The sign on it says it's a state-of-the-art talking weighing machine. He stands on it, puts in a dollar bill, and the machine says, "You weigh 160 pounds, and you are Jewish." Nathan can't believe what he's heard. He gets on it again, puts in another dollar. "You weigh 160 pounds, you are still Jewish, and you're waiting for the 7:35 a.m. train to take you to your job at the bank." Now Nathan is totally shocked, but he's determined to beat the machine. He goes into the men's room, messes up his hair, puts on dark sunglasses, takes off his tie, takes off his jacket, puts it over his arm, sticks a Band-Aid on his chin, goes back out, steps on the machine, puts in another dollar. The machine instantly says, "Nathan, you're still Jewish. You still weigh 160 pounds, but you're also a schlamazel because you just missed your train." That was the new old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Well, okay, it wasn't exactly new, but I've never used it before, so there. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, our young experts on Israel from the Weintraub Israel Center, Ron Benekot and Rotem Rappaport. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So we've been hearing a great deal about the incendiary devices floated over the border with kites, with balloons, rockets, of course, from Gaza. A lot of those things have hit in your neighborhood, really, where you guys come from. And I understand there's a big protest, but I only understood this from you. I don't think people on Too Jewish have heard about this. I haven't seen it publicized in America much. Tell us about it.
Yes, it's a protest of high school students. They're doing a protest walk from where they live, which is in the Gaza Strip, next to the Gaza Strip.
They don't live in the Gaza Strip.
Yes, yes. We don't. They don't have
so
an English.
So it's Kiryat Malachi and but other places. Yeah, Sderot, I assume, mm-hmm. places around the.
Yeah, area. From that area, and they're doing a protest walk to Jerusalem, which is very far away.
What's the term in Hebrew for protest walk?
Tzadat Mecha.
Okay, Tzadat Mecha.
Yes, I think that's the best translation. And they're doing a protest walk just to let people know how they're feeling and what is the situation. And they feel like they don't get recognized much by the rest of the civilization in Israel. So they are trying to draw attention to the situation.
So it's really a way of protesting to the against the Israeli government for not responding strongly enough to the situation.
Right. I think that they feel like nobody listens to them, and they don't want to do anything really extreme, but they feel like, we call it a quiet protest.
Mm-hmm.
So they feel like with walking and skipping school and with the support of the teachers and the principals and all the head of the school, they could get more people involved with this, and especially our politicians and the government.
What do they want? This is a difficult question, but what do they want the government or the army to do about these fires that are burning really in their home areas?
So I feel like they just want somebody to show that they care. Because now it feels like nobody cares, and
if this was happening in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, there'd
exactly.
be tremendous attention
exactly.
paid to it, but not when it's happening way down on the border
exactly.
near Gaza.
So they're trying to get it to be more, trying to get awareness to the situation, and they just feel like they need to hear their voice. That's how you say it?
Get their voices
get
heard.
Their voices
yeah,
heard.
Absolutely. Well, I wish them success, and it reminds me of some of the student protests against the violence in schools here in America, But in an interesting way, and I hope it gets some attention and it brings some support and hopefully ends the difficulty of this terrible situation.
Yeah, we hope so too. Yes.
We will talk next week.
Thank you so much. Bye.
And now a word of Torah. The urge to journey into the unknown is a major motivation in the Torah. We saw it with Abraham a few weeks ago. We find it in the lives of most of our ancestors, and we encounter it perhaps most powerfully in the story of this week's great Torah portion of Vayetse. At the start of the tale, Jacob flees from his brother Esau's potential revenge for having cheated him out of birthright and blessing. Jacob leaves his family and home, both of which are in Beersheba and Canaan, and journeys towards Haran, Abraham's adopted hometown. Haran is located just north of the current Syrian border in eastern Turkey, near Şanlıurfa, between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, in the cradle of civilization. I visited Haran during my sabbatical trip a few years ago. It was then filled with refugees from the Syrian civil war. 3,700 years ago or so, when Jacob headed there, Haran was an important city-state in ancient Syria, and Abraham's kin still lived there. But first, Jacob has to get to Haran, and he is ill-prepared for the journey. He has nothing with him at all, not even a bedroll, and at night he is forced to lay his head on a rock to sleep. In this state of extremis, God brings him a promise in the form of a famous dream, a ladder going to heaven, angels ascending and descending, and a pledge of family, land, and ultimate safety and security. Jacob, our forefather, wakes from the dream and says pointedly, "Hey, God was in this place and I didn't know it." That's something we can all say from time to time, isn't it? For God is in every place and often we don't realize it. Here in Vayetse, Jacob's exclamation provides us with an incredible message of awareness from the true father of our people. But there's another important message in Vayetse. It is that Jacob must leave everything familiar in order to allow him to find God's presence. Throughout human history, religions have been founded by individuals who left ordinary lives and places and wandered off into the wilderness, usually the desert. Abraham, Jacob, and Moses are the most obvious such Jewish pioneers. Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad fit the same pattern. In order to become who we seek to be spiritually, we must begin by leaving what we already know. And then, when we encounter God in the wilderness, we learn that God was back there at home too. We just weren't ready yet to notice that fact. Of all the major figures in Genesis, Jacob is most interesting. He's complex, clever, tricky, bold, resourceful. And he has a spectacularly complicated love life, all of which takes off in this week's Torah portion of Vayetse. But it's at that moment when he realizes how little he really knows, when he has least, that makes him most human and most like us. And it's his journey into the wilderness alone with nothing that helps us understand spirituality is not usually found doing what is most comfortable. Often, we too struggle to figure out where we can find God. If we are lucky and aware, we will come to realize that God is in this place, indeed, in every place. All we have to do is to go out into the wilderness for a bit, open our eyes, and accept that. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest Angela Himsel will share her own remarkable journey from an evangelical doomsday Christian denomination to a committed life as a Jewish wife, mother, and leader. Meet her again when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Our brothers, tens of thousands of Jewish Israelis and visitors came to the West Bank city of Hebron and the Tomb of the Patriarchs at the Cave of Machpelah in a yearly pilgrimage that marked the reading of last week's Torah portion. About 8 days ago, Jews around the world read the Torah portion of Chaye Sarah, in which the biblical patriarch Abraham bought that cave of the patriarchs in Machpelah and Hebron in order to bury his dead wife, Sarah. The Jewish community of Hebron announced that 40,000 people participated in this year's pilgrimage. Tents were set up for group meals. Smaller tents dotted the landscape around the tomb, where families and groups set themselves to camp out for this particular Shabbat. Last week, Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman of Israel announced he had ordered his office to advance planning for the construction of Jewish housing in Hebron. That announcement followed the Israel cabinet approval last month of the establishment of a new Jewish neighborhood in Hebron, the first Jewish housing built for Jewish Israelis in the West Bank city of Hebron in 16 years. The very controversial approval of the nearly $6 million project includes 31 homes, a daycare center, and a park on a site that was formerly an IDF base. The area is known as the Hezekiah Quarter. This plan was approved by the Civil Administration for the West Bank, the defense ministry body that oversees Israel's civil policy in the West Bank. With the Israeli cabinet approval, the project will be implemented. The land on which the project will be constructed was owned by Jews before Israel's establishment in 1948, was later leased by the civil administration to Hebron's Palestinian municipality to create a central bus station, but that was later moved. 500 Jewish Israelis live in Hebron in four neighborhoods, not very many, surrounded by more than 100,000 Palestinians who are not really happy about their presence. The Cave of Machpelah and the Tomb of the Patriarchs is holy to both Jews and Muslims. I'm surprised there haven't been more protests against the new building project in Hebron yet. It is just 31 homes on land that was historically Jewish-owned, but still, does this really make any sense? In other news, when is a 94-year-old man tried as a murderer in juvenile court? Apparently when he was a young Nazi SS guard during the Holocaust. Johann Rebogen, a former Nazi SS guard, now 94 years old, went on trial last week for being complicit in the mass murders of several hundred prisoners at the Stutthof Nazi concentration camp. Rebogen, who uses a wheelchair, worked at the camp between 1942 and 1944 when he was 18, 19, and 20 years old, and therefore he is now being tried in a juvenile court in the western German city of Munster. The trial is scheduled to last to January. It will only convene twice a week on non-consecutive days due to Rebogen's age and failing health. More than 60,000 people were murdered at Stutthof during World War II by the Nazis. Rebogen told investigators he was not aware of the killings, which took place in gas chambers, shots of poison administered directly to the heart or by shooting or exposure. He also insists he did not participate in the murders. "I know nothing." Prosecutors say that he knew about the murders at Stutthof and that the SS guards like him were essential in those killings. The juvenile court has not identified him by name, but his name was made public by the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Gab, the social media site frequented by the anti-Semitic mass murder suspect in the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting and by other far-rightists, is back up on the internet. The site returned a week ago after being taken down by technology providers following the murderous attack that killed 11 worshippers at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. The suspect, Robert Bowers, used the site to rail against Jews and immigrants. Experts say Gab, created 2 years ago as a haven for those on the extreme terroristic right, is rife with hateful speech and threats of violence are sometimes not removed despite being reported. Gab was able to return online with the help of the delivery network company Cloudflare and domain registrar Epic. Cloudflare previously hosted the Daily Stormer, but kicked off the neo-Nazi site after a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia last year turned deadly. CEO Matthew Prince later said he regretted kicking off the site. "Literally, I woke up in a bad mood and decided someone shouldn't be allowed on the internet," Prince wrote. "No one should have that power." Epic CEO Robert Monster, good name, defended providing services to Gab in a blog post. "Deplatforming a haven of free speech is not about left or right," Monster wrote. "Anyone who remembers studying civics is familiar with the concept of inalienable rights, rights that a worthy government can only protect but have no moral authority to take away." I wonder just how far into hate speech this free speech argument goes. Don't you lose moral authority when you are a proximate cause of a mass murder? And finally, while there was a great deal of nasty publicity on the political contributions of Jewish Democratic megadonors George Soros, Michael Bloomberg, and Tom Steyer, it turns out that by far the largest Jewish political donor in these midterm elections last week was billionaire Sheldon Adelson, who contributed huge money to the Republican campaign, more than all three Democratic billionaire donors gave in total on the other side. So actually, there were Jews donating largely on both sides, and the biggest of them all was on the Republican side. Oh, just the facts here on Too Jewish. In actual election results of note that might matter to Jews, in Colorado, Jared Polis, very actively Jewish, was elected governor. He is now America's first openly gay governor. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Angela Hemsel has a new book out with Fig Tree Books called A River Could Be a Tree, a memoir, a fascinating memoir of her journey from, well, as she's noted, really a Christian cult upbringing in southern Indiana to Hebrew University in Jerusalem on a student year abroad program. Catch us up on what happened after that.
Well, I actually ended up staying for 2 years and not for one. I ended up finishing my degree in religious studies and not in English literature, which is what I had planned. And then after that, I went back to Indiana for the summer and, you know, really wasn't that happy, quite frankly, and knew that I wanted to be somewhere else. I was 21 years old. I didn't know exactly where I wanted to be, but I did know I didn't want to be in southern Indiana. And a friend that I had met at Hebrew University, Patty, was living in New York at the time. And so we were speaking, and she said, "Oh, Angie, come to New York. You can, I have somebody you can stay with, and you can find a job." And I don't know, it was like picking up the brochure from Israel. I just said, "Oh, all right, let me just do that." So I moved to New York, and, you know, again, I was with a lot of Jews. I had a lot of Jewish friends, and I found myself more and more estranged, really, from both from my church as well as from Christianity. And many of the questions I'd had about Christianity that I had kind of repressed or ignored because I really, really wanted to get saved, they kept coming to the surface. You know, I just didn't get the whole premise, I guess, of Christianity. And so I was more drawn to Judaism. I was more drawn to asking questions, not necessarily having all of the answers. I still love to have answers, by the way. But I'm accepting that I might not always have them.
You do know what happens when you ask a rabbi a question, of course.
You get three answers.
or at least, or three questions back, actually.
Three
it depends.
Questions back, right, right, exactly. Exactly. So I did find myself more drawn to a more inquisitive way of looking at the Bible, of looking at God, of looking at our place in this world. I was still interested in the basic questions that religion asks, you know, who are we, who created us, what are we supposed to be doing in this world? I just wasn't finding those answers in Christianity, and I was taking classes in New York City. I was going to synagogue now and then, and it just felt more and more natural to me. And then I also fell in love with a Jewish man, and
always a bad idea. I just have to
say. He was a son of a rabbi, actually, not a rabbi. I teased him about that. I said, you know, I took a step down. Anyway.
Well, I'm a son and grandson of a rabbi. I didn't, you know, I just kind of ended up in this field by osmosis, but you fell in love with this RK, this rabbi's kid.
Right, yeah. And, you know, it was, I wasn't really willing or interested, quite frankly, in making a commitment to another religion. I felt that I'd kind of had it with organized religion.
You might have had enough of it growing up in the Worldwide Church of God.
I did. And the other thing is I felt my attitude towards organized religion was incorrect, but it was the way I felt, which was they're going to tell me what to do. And I really don't like being told what to do, especially by people who believe that they have insight directly from God. I don't like it. And I also don't like it when male authority figures tell me what to do. So I wasn't so keen on converting, but I did like Judaism, and I thought I would just sort of dally with it for a bit. And it wasn't until I became pregnant that I felt, you know, it's a decision that's bigger than me. It's also includes my family, and how do I want to raise a family, and who do I want them to be, and who do I want them to be perceived as in the eyes of the world and as in the eyes of the Jewish community. And somehow it just didn't seem like such a big deal. Again, it was like, oh, all right, I'll convert, no problem. So until then, it was not something I was actively looking at. I was just dabbling, I would say.
So you dabbled. Your journey led you once, as you noted, once you became pregnant, eventually led you to a mikveh in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, which is about as far on the planet as you can get from Southern Indiana and your upbringing.
It certainly is, yep.
Maybe not geographically, but in every other way. Tell us a little bit about that last step of the journey.
You know, I think that a lot of people believe or suspect that perhaps I wasn't accepted in the Jewish world, or perhaps my family didn't accept me as being Jewish. And I am happy to say that that is wrong. That is completely incorrect. And I'm happy to know that my choices were not only good for me, but they did not lead to an estrangement with my family, because that would have been very difficult. And I honestly don't know how people make that choice. It's a very painful and difficult choice if you come from a very religious family, whether it's Christian or Jewish, and the choice is either your birth family or your new identity. And I'm very grateful that I didn't have to make that choice. And honestly, the Jewish community in New York City has been more than welcoming. I mean, I'm very involved in the Jewish world in New York City. I'm on the sisterhood board in my synagogue, and my kids...
Which synagogue? I have to ask. Which synagogue?
Oh, the Jewish Center, an Orthodox synagogue on the Upper West Side.
So you went pretty far along in that course of Judaism.
I did. I felt that I, look, I certainly believe, you know, whether you convert, reform, conservative, orthodox, or in whatever way you choose to do so, you are Jewish. But I also know that within the greater world, if I had converted reform or conservative, it would not have been kosher enough, let's just say, not for Israel. And if my kids ever wanted to live in Israel, they would have to start all over again. And also, just not for some of the Jewish community, as unfair as that may seem. And so,
no, of course, that's true.
I felt, you know, it's fine for me. Like, I'm totally okay converting Orthodox. And I was surprised to find that I really found a home in the Orthodox world. I have to say, given the fact that I really was adamant about not being in a religious world that in which men and women were not exactly equal, I'm happy that I go to a more modern Orthodox synagogue, and it's true, there are no female rabbis. But there is a sense of equality, I would say, in the synagogue itself. So it's worked out for me.
Tell me about your family's response. I'm not personally surprised that they accepted you, because I've been in this field a long time, and I've seen that families that are deeply connected religiously often are just happy that their own kids have found their own religious motivation and connection. But tell me how they responded.
My parents, I think, were just fascinated more than anything. They were very supportive. I mentioned a bit in the book about how when I had David, my first, who's 29 now, when I gave birth to him, and it was a boy, my husband said, so, you know, you should call your parents and ask them to come in for the bris. And I said, oh, all right. And he said, and call your friends. And I said, wait, this is a public thing? And he said, yes. And I was just stunned because
there are some cultural things that are not intuitive about Judaism.
No, exactly. And nobody bothered in all of the classes I'd taken to say, and by the way, a bris is a public thing, and there will be sable, and there will be lox and whitefish. I had no clue. So I called my parents, and I said, so, you know, we had a baby boy, and the circumcision is going to be in a week. And they said, okay. And I said to my mother, I said, and I want you and Daddy to come in for it. And she said, oh, you want us to come in? I said, yeah. She goes, oh, okay. And by that time, I still didn't know how big it was going to be. I sort of just thought this was going to be a handful of friends and my parents and Celik's parents. But it had turned into an event, and I think my parents were just completely taken by it. My mother sat right in the front so she could get like a front seat view of the entire proceeding. And they've, ever since then, they were honestly interested and curious about what I did, what I practiced, how I practiced it. I went to Israel quite often, and they always were interested in knowing what I thought about Israel and the issues going on there. So I will say they were very supportive.
In the course of your journey, which, by the way, I mean, the book is beautifully written, and it's also a fast read, I should add, which is not always true. It's a really, really nice book. I was wondering a little bit about how you feel your kids' journeys will be. You know, your parents actually chose the Worldwide Church of God, right? That was a choice coming from Catholic and Lutheran backgrounds. You spell that out clearly in the book. You've chosen such a different course. How will you counsel your own children?
My kids are adults now, and they grew up going to a Hebrew day school through eighth grade. I think they had a good Jewish education. They had, a Jewish home life as well. But I do think and hope that they also are capable of making choices themselves. And I will say that that is one of the most important, I would hope, takeaways in the book, that a river could be a tree, that change is possible. We're entitled to make choices, and we're entitled to make changes that are right for us. And if my kids were to choose to make other decisions besides Judaism, and they have not so far, but if they were, I would hope that I would be as supportive as my parents were, assuming that they didn't make a choice that I really thought was kind of awful. But they haven't. They've been very traditional, I would say, in terms of Jewishness and practice as adults.
The book is called A River Could Be a Tree, a memoir by Angela Himsel. Where can people go to find out more about the book and about you?
Thanks for asking. I do have a website. It's angelahimsel.com. There's a bit about the book in there. And there's a photo gallery, actually, which I have not finished uploading, but I will. And it has photos of my family who appear in the book with little quotes about them. And there's also a section there which has some of my other writing in it as well.
Angela, thanks so much. River Could Be a Tree, available, of course, at Amazon and everywhere else you can find books. Thanks so much for a great visit.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Amy Shinerman, author of the fine new two-volume work, The Talmud of Relationships. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TwoJewishRadio.com website. Our play out this morning comes from a laudable project put together by Robert Miller, a Jewish musician, artist, leader of a jazz rock fusion band. It's a composition dedicated to the victims at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh called Tree of Life. And it's part of a crowdfunding effort to raise money for the victims and their families. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we really pray, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.